welcome to the 378th edition of Travel It's Radio, the show that lets you scratch your lust for travel from the friendly confines of your home. I'm your host, Dan Schlossberg, along with my co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee.
We know you can't travel yet, but we also know that things will change, hopefully sooner than later. In the meantime, we're continuing this weekly show so that a half hour of armchair travel will take you back to the good old days and help you understand that they will come back soon.
Tonight, our guest is Katie O'Reilly, adventure and lifestyle editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome, Katie, to Travel It's Radio.
Thank you so much, Dan and Mary Ellen. I am thrilled to be here. I love Travel It's Radio.
Oh, that's terrific. And we are glad to have you. And we've actually been negligent in not promoting the Sierra Club before tonight. So we're glad you accepted our invitation. For listeners who might not know, please tell us what the Sierra Club is and what it does.
Sure. So the Sierra Club is America's oldest and most influential grassroots conservation group. It was founded by Scottish-American preservationist John Muir, a pretty big explorer in his own right, in 1892. The Sierra Club's motto is explore, enjoy, and protect. And they want to make people fall in love with the great outdoors and with the natural world so that they are more inclined to act to protect it and save it and make it better. And so the Sierra Magazine is the storytelling arm of the Sierra Club. And we're sort of a thought of as an enjoyable bonus that you get with membership. And so therefore our editorial goals are to inspire readers to explore, enjoy, and protect.
Since the Sierra Nevada Mountains are a western range that borders California, does the club take its name from them, and does it cover the same area that the mountains do?
Dan, it does take its name from them. When the Sierra Club started in 1892, it started in San Francisco, and it was basically a mountaineering club for men from the Bay Area to go out and have adventures in the Sierra Nevada mountains. So we definitely have a strong legacy there. We have a lot of lodges. The Sierra Club has a lot of lodges up in the Sierras. However, it's not super applicable anymore. We are a national group. We're a national magazine. And really, you know, the club's objectives at this point are promoting sustainable energy and mitigating global warming and opposing the use of coal. Things have kind of gotten a lot more national in scope, even international in some ways, and more political since then. But we do have that very strong Sierra Nevada legacy.
Can you tell us more about Sierra Magazine? How often does it come out, and what kind of topics does it cover?
Absolutely. So it's a bi-monthly magazine. It comes out every 2 months. And we cover political issues, we cover science and nature, we do a lot of ecocentric arts and culture coverage, we cover activists and the general environmental movement, and my favorite, I get to handle the fun stuff, I feel pretty lucky, is adventure and green lifestyle. And by adventure, I mean human-powered outdoor adventure and the gear that facilitates it and the amazing places that you can go and reap all the benefits of human-powered outdoor adventure, by which I mean hiking, paddling, climbing, cycling, mountain biking, anything that doesn't cause you to have to spew emissions into the atmosphere.
And what's the history of the magazine? When did it start? How big an audience does it reach? Is there also an online component? Lots of questions.
Oh, absolutely. So the magazine actually traces its roots to 1893 when the Sierra Club Bulletin came out. And it was something that, and at this point, you know, this is 1 year after the Sierra Club started. It's still pretty much an adventure club. It's sort of like London's Explorer Club, but for mountain men in the West. And they cover all sorts of kind of nature and adventure news as the Bulletin. And the Bulletin continued to come out for years and years and years. And it was in the latter half of the 20th century that the bulletin kind of morphed into the familiar glossy magazine that you see today and see on newsstands. That is Sierra Magazine. And its audience is pretty large. There are 3.8 million members of the Sierra Club. I think you have to pay at least $50 a year or something like that to get the magazine as a benefit of subscription. So our circulation is technically around 900,000. And we are also on newsstands at Barnes & Noble and REI and a lot of specialty kind of outdoor adventure stores.
And is there an online component?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I missed that part. There's absolutely an online component. And actually, at this point, we do a lot more, probably as of about three or four years ago, we actually publish a lot more content online than we do in the book. And so we publish about two or three web-exclusive stories daily, meaning that they're stories that don't appear in the book. And the website is, I find the website to be a lot of fun because we can kind of, we can chase the news and cultural trends a little bit more closely. We can kind of take more risks. I love editing travel and adventure stories in particular for the website because we're not quite as constrained by print space and word count. And, you know, we can spin longer yarns. And we also use our website as a way to try and engage a younger audience. So the Sierra Club, its demographics skew toward the 65 and older Caucasian reader. You know, most 30% of our print readers have graduate degrees. With our web content, we're trying to engage younger millennials and Generation Z in the environmental movement. So it's kind of a different beast. It's a little bit different in tone. It's free. We want it to be more accessible to everyone. You can go to sierramagazine.org and read everything on the whole site for free. It's a good time.
Fantastic. We're talking with Katie O'Reilly, adventure and lifestyle editor of Sierra Magazine.
And as adventure and lifestyle editor, how much of your job is writing and how much is editing, Katie? And do you make your own assignments or use staff writers and freelancers?
Oh, that is a great question, Tan. So a lot of my job is editing. I would say I spend about 65 or 70% of my day editing and, you know, conceiving of stories and making assignments and looking for writers to solicit. And then I do a fair amount of my own writing for the site, probably about 30% of the time. And we often do make our own assignments. You know, we have editorial meetings every Monday where we look at what's going on that week and we say, you know, what do we want to cover? And, you know, I don't think that I have to tell your audience that environmental news can be pretty depressing these days. It can be heavy stuff. So we really try and balance it with a lot of lighter lifestyle and travel-oriented pieces that, you know, inspire people to live a greener lifestyle and to get out and adventure. So every week we're kind of looking at that balance, you know, what's going on in the news and how much do we want to distract people and tell them about awesome places to go to see amazing birds or to snorkel with incredible fish or to hike incredible trails. And, you know, so we make some assignments based on that, but I probably get dozens of pitches every week from very seasoned travel journalists and lifestyle writers and science writers and, film and book reviewers who have story ideas. And I really encourage that because a lot of times you don't know what you want until it's right in front of you. So we probably decide what we want and go out and get it maybe 25% of the time. And the rest of the stories we publish are either written in house or they are based on pitches we've gotten from freelance writers. And in terms of staff writers, we're kind of a small but mighty team. There are 6 editors, and we all do a fair amount of writing ourselves, too. And we also, at any given time, employ 3 editorial fellows. And this used used to be an internship program, and now we pay the interns. And instead of having, you know, four college kids for four months at a time, we have three pretty serious and accomplished early career journalists. Oftentimes, they're recent graduates or they're in grad school. And they stay with us for 6 months at a time and work 30 hours a week and are paid. And they do a lot of writing as well and a lot of fact-checking. We're a very heavily fact-checked magazine, so that's a big part of our operation.
Katie, we hear a lot about sustainable travel, preserving the environment, and protecting flora and fauna, especially endangered species. How is Sierra Magazine involved in those objectives?
Oh, we are just 1,000% involved in all of those objectives. And, you know, we try really hard to make those objectives very accessible, you know, from people who are dark green. We call them dark green. You know, they've been involved in environmental activism for much of their lives, and you know, they know a lot about ecology, to people who are, you know, kind of, I think of, like, you know, my suburban parents in suburban Chicago, you know, who know these are serious issues, but they don't necessarily know a ton about them. Like, we try and create through our stories entry points for people who are at all sorts of phases of environmental involvement and ecological awareness. And, you know, I love doing critter stories. Those tend to perform really well for us, and we have some really, really talented art and photography staff we work with, and photographers that we commission all over the world. So we do a fair amount of photo essays featuring endangered species, featuring vulnerable places like rainforests and rice fields and ocean dependent areas, islands that are very vulnerable to the effects of climate change, just to kind of expose people to what's going on all over the world. I like your phrase, armchair travelers. We try and create a lot of armchair conservationists. You know, we talk to the scientists who are on the front lines out there, and we show what they're doing, and to the activists on the front lines, and the adventurers, and, you know, we also do a lot of stories about, you know, what it's going to take in terms of policy and in terms of individual action to preserve and improve the environment. Yes, and then sustainable travel. You know, I like to think that we want to show people the natural wonder of the world and inspire them to think more critically about it and to hopefully experience it for themselves. So we do a fair amount of travel pieces too, but our travel pieces tend to be, you know, it's not so much, you know, here's what the hotel was like, here's what the food was like. Although we do a lot of food stories, but they're more kind of about food supply and agricultural issues. But they tend to be more about kind of being out in a natural environment, and that human powered adventure angle.
Is the American West the primary territory of Sierra Magazine, or do you go to Canada too? And do you get to travel with your job?
So we are nationally focused. So the American West is not the primary territory. We try really hard to, you know, do stories about the Southeast and the Midwest and the Northeast and the Southwest and to do occasional international stories too. We probably only do a small handful of international stories a year. We're more domestic focused. But we also cover a fair amount of Canada. It's separate, but there is a Sierra Club Canada. And of course there are a lot of pipeline issues going on in Canada and a lot of incredible, indigenous preserved, wild places, that we look at how they're managed and how people can access them, in incredible places to explore in Canada. And, you know, your question about whether I get to travel with my job, I used to before March of this year. And, you know, I'm kind of speaking in before times now. You know, I was definitely at my desk the vast majority of days, but I certainly got to go on a fair amount of adventures that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. you know, most of it was kind of hiking adventures in the backcountry. I did a story two summers ago now where I backpacked the Lost Coast Trail in far north California with my dog. I did a story where I went and did a lot of via ferratas, which are climbing walls where you sort of climb around the mountains. They're rather than over the mountains. I did some backpacking trips. I have gone camping with groups of single mother veterans, which some studies showed was the demographic least likely to go outside on an outdoor adventure. So I did a story where, we got a lot of them together and went camping and sort of wrote about their experiences. I used to travel probably 6 to 10 times a year for my job.
You touched on the Keystone Pipeline. Does Sierra Magazine get involved in political issues?
They absolutely do. A big part of the Sierra Club is lobbying politicians for political change. So, everyone's very thrilled right now that the three major pipeline projects in the U.S. have, as I think as recently as within the past month, have been called off and declared unlawful. So, I haven't because I'm adventure and lifestyle, I don't personally report much on issues like the Keystone Pipeline, but the Sierra Club is absolutely involved. I mean, during what was happening with Standing Rock, the Sierra mm-hmm. Club dispatched a lot of people up there, and we did a fair amount of coverage on that. We're also doing a fair amount of coverage on what's going on at the border wall and the indigenous groups that are acting to stop the construction, largely based on the ecological threats it would pose. The endangered ecosystems, the plants and the jaguars and the animals that would be endangered.
Mm. We're talking with Katie O'Reilly, adventure and lifestyle editor of Sierra Magazine.
Katie, climate change is no longer on the back burner. For example, the frequency, duration, and severity of both summer and winter storms has become worse. Are we on the brink of disaster with rising ocean levels, especially in places like Miami and New Orleans?
Dan, that is such a good point that climate change is no longer on the back burner. I mean, even since I started this job 4 years and some change ago, it has the topic has just become so much more mainstream with the average news consumer so much more knowledgeable about what's happening, and I hate to say it, but we really are on the brink of disaster with rising ocean levels. The latest reports from the I can't remember the acronym right now, but the UN group that monitors climate change have all said that, we've got some 11, 12 years to make very, very drastic changes in the levels of emissions. That's the carbon dioxide and the methane and the nitrate that are released when we burn fossil fuels to heat our homes and electrify everything we need to do, and manufacture meat and everything. And so that's going to take some serious, serious collective action and, some serious policies that it's going to be life as we don't know it anymore to reverse that course of action and make it so that life is tenable for our children and grandchildren. But I do think that we've had a major wake up. And I think people are finally on a large scale, listening up. I honestly think the coronavirus pandemic has been kind of key to that. I mean, we've seen that it's sort of a shorter feedback loop global crisis that we've experienced, and we've seen that we need to make major changes immediately. And so I think that's really going to kind of inform climate policies moving forward. I think that places like Miami and New Orleans, I mean, gosh, they luckily, we at this point, we know a lot about coastal erosion and all the kind of architectural and landscape planning and city planning that needs to go into protecting these kinds of places and making sure that they continue to thrive. But I do think that moving forward, we're going to see a lot of people leaving these coastal places, and cities in the middle of the country are going to blow up, and people are going to tread inland, places where they know they can have good freshwater supply, and where they are not as subject to rising ocean levels. I wish I had a crystal ball. I think things are looking really, really bad, but I also have a lot of hope in terms of how people are waking up and the types of climate bills that we're seeing introduced in Congress on local, regional, and federal levels at this point.
Another ecological issue, Katie, is the burning of the Amazon rainforest. What kind of harm is it causing, and what can be done to stop that?
Gosh, so, you know, before the coronavirus pandemic, I really thought that the Amazon rainforest burning was just going to be the story of 2020 and late 2019. Because, yes, I mean, it is just when trees burn, especially as many of the Amazonian rainforest trees are, you know, they're old growth, they're ancient trees, that just releases massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you know, which goes on to fry the planet. And it also threatens a lot of trees and animals that are critical to the ecosystem, and just raises that land and a lot of, you know, the resources that a lot of the indigenous communities depend on there and a lot of animals depend on are just gone. So it just throws everything out of whack. And it really, you know, like we are in the midst of the sixth great extinction right now, and the Amazon burning did not help that at all. In terms of what can be done to stop it, I mean, I think that it was sort of one of those disasters that really woke people up. And there are so many reforestation initiatives going on right now. And it's almost kind of like the 70s when everyone wanted to protect the old growth forests in Northern California and Washington. We're seeing that all over the world, and tons of replanting. And I think that, you know, we've really kind of come to embrace plants. It's you know, everyone who's stuck home all the time now, is a lot of people are spending all their time in the garden, or they've really gotten into houseplants, cooking a lot. I mean, it's just caused us all to think a lot harder about where all the resources that we depend on come from, especially when there are food supply issues and we can't just get everything we need from the grocery store, say. So I think that people are much more clued into the natural processes of the world right now. And, you know, hopefully all these reforestation initiatives pay off.
Well, you talked earlier about how the Sierra Club was lobbying, doing some lobbying. Could you talk more about how the Sierra Club, how Sierra Magazine helps in those efforts? And how are you lobbying to pass environmentally friendly legislation?
Yes. So, you know, the Sierra Magazine is seen as a big education tool. So we just want to fill our members in on, and our readers in on, the issues that are so central to the Sierra Club at a given time. You know, we have columns like Faces of Clean Energy that are just showing all the, where we kind of do an as told to report by someone who works in the solar or the wind industry. Oftentimes they're technicians or they're photographers or someone, and you know, they just talk about their jobs, and we want to show the depth and breadth of those fields. And in terms of, you know, I don't really know the ins and outs of what the lobbyists do at the Sierra Club. I know that, you know, we raise a lot of awareness around issues. Oftentimes they get pretty colorful with their displays and their activism. You know, they do everything. They have all sorts of voter mobilization efforts in play. You know, at this point, because we can't really do much door to door, there are a lot of texting campaigns and spreading. We endorse political candidates who have environmentally friendly track records and who've kind of shown us that they're invested in really, really hopeful climate policy, and we really act on behalf of those candidates.
What's your opinion of the Green New Deal created by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
I think it's just so brilliant and so visionary, and it makes so much sense. You know, I've even seen in the wake of the all the jobs lost where I live in California with the coronavirus pandemic, there are a lot of initiatives to get people out there, you know, replanting trees. People who've lost their jobs. It's inherently socially distanced, and so I think that that AOC is really onto something there. I think I frankly think it doesn't go quite far enough, and I think that it's been really amazing to see how, you know, it started as this kind of like far-fetched idea, and it became a real mainstream point of conversation, and that Biden has really embraced a lot of it. So it gives me a lot of hope.
We're talking with Katie O'Reilly, adventure and lifestyle editor of Sierra Magazine.
And Katie, with time running down, does the Sierra Club work closely with the World Wildlife Federation and other groups trying to prevent certain species from going extinct? And what are some of those species?
I don't know the ins and outs of the Sierra Club's relationships with other environmental groups on that front, but yes, they do work with other influential groups like World Wildlife Federation, and oh gosh, so many animals are endangered. You know, so many, like I was just editing a story earlier about the Chinese paddlefish, which you know, introduced the concept of extinction debt. Like we know it's on its way out. How do we maximize its time here? So all sorts of ocean creatures are going extinct, as are unfortunately really charismatic megafauna like elephants and giraffes and the poor orangutans. You know, really took a hit with all the rainforest burning. So I mean, really, it's almost they're saying now like 50% of the creatures on our planet now are going to be extinct without massive concerted action within the next 10 to 15 years. So you talk about any group of animals, there are a lot of close calls in those groups, unfortunately.
Katie, if Travel Itch Radio listeners wish to make a donation to the Sierra Club and subscribe to Sierra Magazine, how do they do that?
It's pretty easy to become a Sierra Club member online, and you can join for, you know, $10 a year. Don't quote me on that. But there are all sorts of levels of membership and all sorts of benefits, and you'll get all sorts of information about what's going on in the environmental world and sphere. And if you just Google join the Sierra Club, it's very easy, and you'll see what level you need to be at to receive Sierra Magazine.
Our guest tonight on Travel Itch Radio has been Katie O'Reilly, adventure and lifestyle editor of Sierra Magazine. Thank you, Katie, for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan and Mary Ellen. I've really enjoyed this.
Good. Our pleasure. And that's it for this edition of Travel Itch Radio. Next week, we'll talk to Chesak, executive director of the Outdoor Writers Association of America. Now, this is Dan Schlossberg, along with co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, saying thank you for your time this time. Until next time, good night and stay safe.